Please repeat. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om mangalam gurudevaya devye matriksha mangalam mangalam bhakta brindebhyo sarva lokaya mangalam om stavakaya charadmasya sarvadharma sarupine avatara varishta ramakrishnaya mangalam om sarashiva samarambam shankaracharya majamam ashmar achara prayantam vande gurum paramparam. We're continuing our readings from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Right now we're in the seventh skanda, the seventh book. And last week I think we read from chapter 11. I'm pretty sure chapter 11. And that was a section that was introducing this varnashram system, especially the varna, which is translated as caste, but the four stratified society, the duties and qualities and responsibilities of the brahmanas, the kshatriyas, the vaishyas, and the sudras. And so then the next section is about the varnas, because we call this varnashram system. Actually, the person who's speaking right now is Yudhisthira, is asking Narada Muni, right, King Yudhisthira. And he's asking specifically, his first question is, what is Sanatana Dharma? Right. What is the eternal religion by which is beneficial for every human being, every person, not just brahmanas, vaishyas, sudras, brahmacharis, sannyasis, grihasthas, like this. What is a universal dharma that is applicable to everybody? And so he lists, we gave a couple talks, actually one full talk, and then we mentioned again the following week, about the 30 qualities, he says, that one sanatana dharma can be described as if having 30 parts, right? And he gave like satyam, tapas, saucha, and daya, the first four, right? Means truthfulness, cleanliness, compassion, and austerity, self-control. These are the first four, and he keeps going on with these type of things. And he says these are universally applicable because it is not dharma as in like a duty. This is one's fundamental nature. He uses the term swadharma. Our fundamental nature, truth is our nature, right? Honesty is our nature. And we're not being truthful, then we're not being us. We're not being human. We're denying a quality of the soul, right? Dharma is defined many different ways. One of the definitions is something's intrinsic nature. A human being. His nature is to be honest. His nature is to be self-controlled and dignified. His nature is to be pure and clean and radiant. Nature is to be compassionate, like this. And so we're not doing that. And we're covering, what is it? Then we call, pretty soon we can make commandments. Thou shalt, brush your teeth. Thou shalt, and actually you see in the scriptures, there's a thing called Dharma Shastra. There's 30 pages on how a Brahmin has to brush their teeth. Right, they've codified it into laws, right? But the point is, you can make laws like this, but it's our nature to be clean. It's our nature to be honest, right? We don't have to make laws. And not to do it, the scriptures say, that's sin. What is sin? Using this definition. It's not, sin is simple definition. Sin is going against the dictates of the scriptures. Simple definition. Right? Krishna says in the Gita, let the scriptures be the standard for what you should do, what you shouldn't do. Right? So that's what's virtue and what is sin. But that's a simple answer to this, because a society or a religion or a scripture tells you to do something, to disobey, that's sin. Right? That's not a very satisfying, that's the usual definition, and it's an impossible definition, but it's not a fully satisfying definition. Using this understanding, this larger definition of dharma as one's intrinsic nature, sin is going against your nature, right? Covering your nature rather than opening your nature. Swami Vivekananda, he redefined religion, or his clarification of the definition of religion is a manifestation of the divinity already in man. Right? We're already divine. Uncover it and let it shine forth. That is religion. Right? So virtue is uncovering your divinity. And sin is covering your divinity. So it's a nice simple definition. This actually takes any guilt, any guilt or pride of good and bad behavior out of it. Manifest your divinity or cover your divinity. If you're honest, you manage and your divinity shines, right? If you're dishonest, you cover your divinity, right? Simple definition. So he gives these, but Yudhisthira also asks, tell me that Sanatana Dharma, which Narada Muni answered with these four and then other qualities of the nature of the qualities of a human being should aspire for to uncover their latent divinity. He says, but also related to that, Yukta, he says, that's Varnashram Dharma, the Sanatana or universal Dharma, eternal Dharma, and Varnashram Dharma, specifying what it means. In the stratified society, we're not stratified like this. We have different economic stratifications, educational stratifications, but in the Vedic tradition, according to one's nature, one's inclination, one's tendencies is the type of work one did. And then it was clear what your duties were. It wasn't complicated and confusing. For us, we can grow up our whole, we can be 40, 50 years old and not know what we want to do when we grow up. Right, we don't know what our nature is, we don't know if we're doing it right. We don't know what our duty is to our parents, to our family, to our children, to our job, to our country, to our religion, to our temple. You know, it's everything's complicated. We don't have. So there's some benefit to having clearly defined duties, right? But there's also, as we can imagine, especially for people born and raised in this country, it seems potentially a little bit stifling that your duties are chosen for you. But we have to understand the principle behind it. So last week we studied the four varnas. Now the next section he starts talking about the ashramas. The ashramas are the stages of everyone's life. Varnas are stratified in society, right? Different jobs or different tendencies or different personalities in society. But everybody in every varna also grows up, is a child, grows, becomes a young adult, gets old, and eventually gets elderly and then dies. This is a universal story, you know. I've just told everybody the biography. You were born. We're all cute at one time. Even me. I guarantee. I have pictures to prove it. But it didn't last long because we had adulthood. We grew old, which is also in front of you, watching it happen in the mirror every day. And the body's automatically going through stages. So the scripture says that you cannot expect the same behavior from a child as you do from an adult. Right, we try them differently in court, even, right? We don't expect the same behavior. We don't expect the same standard, the same knowledge. And so, but the scriptures give guidance. It says when your Sanatana Dharma is going well, automatically you go through stages, right? We don't know. So they describe it as this four, they like to categorize the four main stages of life. The first main is the first 25. This is very idealized. Somebody asked me one time, people always talk about the four stages of life. Was there ever a time that all India or the whole world followed these four stages of life as they were? So there's no pure evidence of that. We all the Vedic times, people followed the Vedas. These are Vedic times, right? The Vedas are eternal. We're also struggling. We're actually following them automatically. You don't have to. The scriptures don't have to tell you that you're going to grow, that you're going to eventually grow up and get old, right? It automatically happens. So this is a little idealized form. It's also our common experience. The first 25 years, what do? Even in this country, we study, right? We're usually single, and we study. This is that we call brahmacharya ashram. Brahmacharya means celibate student, right? Or unmarried. A better definition is unmarried student, right? In this country, unmarried doesn't necessarily mean celibate student, right? But traditionally, in almost every country, in every culture in the world, everywhere, from all time except now and here, right? Unmarried usually meant basically celibate, right? Not yet married, right? So it's a little so I think there we have to understand the changing times, perhaps. But what's the changing time? We're going against perhaps our natural tendencies. Our natural tendencies is, this is in society, if we go well, we spend our youth and the energies of the body and the energies of the mind, right? We use that shakti, right, for study and to become healthy and strong, right? And that's called brahmacharya ashram. Then idealized form, around 24, 25 years old, then one gets married, usually, right? This is not universally applicable, but most people get married around this time, right? And then that same energy is used differently. What's that same shakti in the body, in the mind that we're born with, where does it go? It goes for the production of children, right? And for the economic development, right? And security, and building your family, and like that, and educating the next level, the next generation of brahmacharis, celibate students, until they get married, right? That. But then, so that we also have, roughly, in our culture. But then, after, it says, around 50, 56 years old, it says when the children are raised and can take care of themselves, right, what do? Right? Most people keep working. More people keep having children. You know, there's medications now. It's 60, 70, 80 years old, even, with hormones. I can have children very old, and men can father children very old with new medications like this. But that's not... We can do that because we have scientifically figured out how to. But that's not nature's way. Nature automatically, the body changes at a certain time, right? And so what happens at that time, the scriptures say we should then pull back from our external, that same energy which is now a little bit less, naturally, we should use what's left to focus a little more on devotional things, the spiritual things. Right? And then at the end of life, if possible, when there's not much real opportunity for material enjoyment, in old age, what can you do? How much can you enjoy? You can't even eat a proper meal without being sick, right? You can't. What can you do? You can't. What physical enjoyment can you really have? We keep trying. With new medicines and new this and new that, we can try to enjoy. No, then the senses are automatically less. The power of the senses is less. Put them. Therefore, they're not pulling the mind. Put the mind somewhere else. It's called sannyas, right? So the scripture. These are called the four ashrams. And does anybody know what ashram means? The word ashram. Ashrama means shelter. Right? It's not a building. We call this an ashram. Right? What is it? Because this is a shelter where the monks live. This is our shelter. Right? But so also a house where pious householders live. They call it grihastha ashram. That's also your ashram. Householder, the married life is called grihastha ashram. Why? Because it's also shelter. Right? Shelter from just wasting your life. Right, to not unfolding the divinity within, right. So in each of these stages, in youth, we know how many obstacles and are there, and distractions are there in youth, in a young adulthood even more, right. And then when you hit 40, 50, then a whole other set of new obstructions and difficulties may be coming, right. So this whole system is designed so we can go through these natural stages with dignity, and understand. What the focus should be, not to lose our focus. So in the Brahmacharya Ashram, what's traditionally, these verses, you'll please excuse, is being spoken to Yudhisthira, and it's a summary of Dharma Shastra, which and so it's being spoken to a man with some masculine slant. But the principles we can understand and apply them in any situation, right? The first stage is one goes to the house of the guru, right? Men would leave home actually. Right, at 12, right? They'd leave home, they'd be sent to a school, I guess nowadays it'd be called a boarding school, right? You'd be the house of the guru. You'd be a married guru who would teach the Vedas, all these things from 12 to 24. And there's an investor, there's initiation where the boy gets a sacred thread and shaved his head and gets his ears pierced, all that type of stuff, right? Now, in ancient times also, there were such schools for girls, right, but actually, this dramatic initiation and rebirth that a boy has to go through happens automatically for a girl, with menstruation. It's a natural shift. Boys have to be almost beat into it, into like now you're into a new stage, right? So they have to leave, right? Rather than because there's no the biological change isn't dramatic enough to change the consciousness, so they have to actually leave home, right? In traditional cultures, women didn't have to leave home. Who were there taught. The elder woman had the knowledge to teach, right? In the man's house, the men have the technology. They're out working, or they have so they have to go to somebody who knows how to teach. Professional teachers, we call them gurus in the olden days, right? And they live with the guru for 12 years until 24, and then they have a choice. Most within, because their body is changing, will want to get married, right? And so they're given instructions. So during those 12 years, from 12 to 24, what do they learn? They learn the scriptures. They learn proper behavior, proper etiquette, a lot of self-discipline, how to do fire ceremony, yoga, also the things they need when they're married, all those details, they also math, math reading, everything is taught, right, in that way, right, but a very disciplined life, right, and then why that strict discipline? So that when they get married, they don't lose their self, because automatically, from the watchful eye of the guru, with a stick in hand, usually, my guru still carries a stick. I'm not scared to use it, right? With stick in hand, right? It's you behave one way, but all of a sudden you have a new thing. You have a pretty wife, a handsome husband, right? A nice job, your own apartment, or whatever the cultural situation. It's easy to forget what the goal is, to get lost in enjoyment, right? And so, but that training you had in youth will hopefully go for the boy they learn in school, with the parent, with the girls they learn at home in the old way. Now it's changed. What they learn from their parents, they don't lose their focus in the next stage of life. And similarly, then all that continues. Then they live a pious householder life. And then because of their austerity, even some austerities in householder life, the devotional practices, then they're ready for retirement, right? Sri Ramakrishna says that you see in old, and we totally see this here, he sees elderly people playing cards, right? As if they don't, I guess, because time hangs heavy on their head, Sri Ramakrishna said, right? They're about to die and they're playing cards, right? If we play cards, it's like we're still wasting time. Right, you play what are the Angry Birds too much? It's wasting time, right? But if you're on your deathbed and you're doing so, right? This is very foolish, right? So he says, but what do you do if you don't have any training? If you don't have any taste in spiritual practices? If you have no, people say, oh, I'll do it when I'm older. I'll do it when I'm older, right? If you don't have the taste when you're young, what are you going to do when you're old, right? And so you have to develop. So that's why. So when you, if Brahmacharya Ashram is good, Grihastha Ashram is good, means. Then retirement will be proper. You can utilize your life properly. And then, maybe when if the mind is ready, then one can completely renounce everything, continue to focus on God. So, I was this morning I was working on the verses on the Brahmacharya Ashram. And I like these verses very much. It describes how they look, and you have to have dreadlocks, and you have to have Brahman thread, and you have to carry an antelope skin, and you have to carry a kusha grass mat and a stick and a kamandalu, and they have to go out begging twice a day for their guru's food, they have to do Gayatri, they have to chant Gayatri twice a day, they have to do all these different prayers, they have to serve the guru and clean his house, and you know, all the, like this, right? And I like this stuff because I live in this monastic type of world, right? And so so he starts with this long description of Brahmacharya Ashram, then a long description of Vanaprastha, retired life. And that's also very, very difficult. It goes into living on leaves and fruit in the forest, and also having dreadlocks and and how when you're ready to die, you have to withdraw your senses, and this whole description of how to die, and then very long description of sannyasa ashram, monastic life. And I love that, because that describes what I'm supposed to try to be doing. Right, and so as I was working on the Brahmacharya part, and I said, well, it's very interesting, I will translate it, because I haven't skipped too much of the Bhagavatam translating, so I'll work on it. But it may only be interesting to me what type of haircut a Brahmacharya should have in the forest, or what type of stick, how tall the stick should be. So I jumped ahead a little bit after lunch, realizing I'd maybe get ahead of him. Because that's, so Yudhisthira, after he gives a long, Narada, long talk on Brahmacharya Ashram, long talk on Vanaprastha Ashram, and an even longer talk in Sannyasa Ashram, then Yudhisthira, we'll pick up chapter 14, what he says. Yudhisthira then asks, O divine sage, O Devarishi, Narada Muni is called Devarishi, kindly explain how a householder like myself, what about like, that's all fine, you've been talking for hours, what about like me, what am I supposed to do? That's really the question. We want to know the worst, that's why I like those sections, they tell me what I'm supposed to do, right? So he says, what about the rest of us, right? What about most people, right? What are their duties? How can they live Sanatana Dharma as householders, as through this Varnashram system? He says, Grihastam etam paravim vidhina yena channache yada devarasa brindu griham mudha di. It's interesting. He's a little bit criticizing. He's analyzing himself. You see, I'm absorbed in his family life. Griha mudha di. And therefore, I'm confused about what my goal is. Because I'm absorbed with my duties, right? I'm confused about the goal. Right, so the rest, what about us who are absorbed, like me, he says, who are absorbed in our duties and our jobs and families, and therefore confused about our goal? What are we supposed to do? What's the job for us? Right, according to the Vedas, like what do the Vedas say about this? Right. Narada Uvacha, Sri Narada says, so we'll take another. It's taken a long time to even get to verse 2, but please forgive. But it's important to remember. This section is about these intricate rules and principles of the Varnashram system. And there's huge code books called Dharma Shastra, Laza, Manu, and others, that describe these in minute detail, almost painful, life-stifling details, perhaps, right? You know, all these rules, regulations, restrictions, and the scriptures are full of such rules and principles and guidances, right? But one of the authors of many of these texts is Vedavyas, who authored this book. At the end of writing all the Vedas, or recording all the Vedas, and writing the Mahabharata, right, and Brahma Sutra, right, he was not still depressed. He says, why is my mind not happy? Right, so he came to Narada, who's speaking now also, his guru, and says, why am I not happy? I've done everything. I'm an incarnation of God, actually, and I've done my duty. My duty is to record all the scriptures, right, the Puranas and all the Puranas, so many things he wrote, right, 18 Puranas. And he says, you've done good, but you've missed one point. You forgot to point out that what the real gati is, what the real goal is. What's the goal of the Vedas? What's the goal of life? What's the goal of everything? What's the purpose of all these stories? What's the purpose of all these rules? Right? He says, therefore, I want you to retell all the stories and all the rules and everything again. Do it all over again from beginning. From Brahma laying down the cosmic ocean and the lotus coming out of his... Vishnu lying in the cosmic ocean with lotus coming out of his navel and creation from the creation of the world on. Tell it all again. But point out why. What's it all for? Right, so he says, you forgot to mention bhakti. Devotion is the purpose of everything. Right, loving God and finding the source of everything and connecting with that through loving devotion, that's the purpose. Right, so that's the purpose of all the stories. That's the purpose of all the rules, all dharma. And the purpose of all the varnas and the ashramas. Right, so now he's telling again the rules and regulations in a simple form. Right, why? So we know what we can do, what we need to do without forgetting, without losing our devotion. So you're going to be told from a devotional standpoint. So the point is to take why such principles are there, not to get caught on the rules and regulations, right? So he says, one state at home, griheshu, O king, should perform suitable work. Suitable work. Yatochita means suitable work according to reference to the previous section on the varnas, according to one's nature, right? Do the work that suits you, that's your nature to do, right? And that's not forbidden work. It means like there's some called ugakama, reprehensible things. You shouldn't do that, right? If truthfulness is the universal principle, you shouldn't make your living dishonestly. If dhaya is the universal principle, you shouldn't make your living by violence, right? If honesty is if a self-control is your principle, you shouldn't make your living by intoxication, right? You know, like selling drugs and being, you know, like this is not, so this is the principle. So you should do suitable work according to your nature. It's not bad work. It's not against your fundamental nature, right? Do honest works, good work, right? Right. One should perform suitable work. And then he says, Vasudeva arpanam. Was offering everything to Vasudev, right? Do everything as an offering to Vasudev. We start Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We bow to that all-pervading Lord. Vasudeva, we've talked many times, has two meanings, that which is all-pervading, the universal consciousness in everyone's heart, and he's also the son of Vasudev. He's also the incarnation of God, like Krishna. That's the name for Krishna. Both the infinite God and the personal God, right? That do everything for him. Do everything for that, right? Do everything, do good work, offer it for him. Do it as a result to him. And upasitta mahamunihi, sakshat upasitta mahamunihi. Upasitta, one should as worship for mahamuni, for great saints, for sadhus and devotees, right? Do your work, offer the results for the benefit of God and for the devotees, for the saints. Right, for the mahatmas, right? You should utilize your money, your attention, you know, struggle, do as you, everything you need to do, but don't forget God, don't forget the devotees. Right? Whenever there is time, shravanam bhagavata abhishiktam avatara. When there is time? When you're working, what is time? Maybe before work or after when you come home from work like this. Listen, shravanam, to stories about Bhagavan. Right, like the Bhagavatam. Actually, you use the word Bhagavatam, which means the stories about Bhagavan and about the Lord, that Lord, and his incarnations. Hear Lila, Krishna Katha, Lila Katha. Hear about Rama, hear about Krishna. Hear about Ramakrishna, hear about Jesus, about the avatars, God and his avatars. God manifests. And that's Bhagavan, that's Vasudeva, the all-pervading and the incarnate God. Right? When there is time to time, regularly, whenever you find some time, think of God, hear about God, read about God. But specifically says, that he says, avatara katamritam, the nectar words. Right? The gospel of Ramakrishna, Ramakrishna Katamritam. Right? That's right. Yeah, I'm making sure I get it right. The gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is called the nectar-like words of Sri Ramakrishna. Right? So this is the thing, the teachings of the leelas of the avatar. Katam, listen to the nectar-like. What is it nectar-like? Nectar because it gives life. Right? And nectar also means, Amrita means without death, the eternal words. Anything else you read, anything else you hear is temporary. Maybe great. Right, it'd be a great show on TV, but after it, how much influence it had almost no influence. It entertains you a little bit, right? But you hear something, you hear about the Bhagavad, and you hear from the scriptures. This is eternal knowledge, and it's eternally beneficial. So don't waste all your time. When there's time daily, listen to the sublime, life-giving, eternal teachings about God and His avatars, right? With shadho dina yata kalam, with faith. And upashanta janavrita, and in the company of those who are upashanta, who are completely mentally satisfied and pacified, and completely so do so in the company of those who are peaceful. It's another name for devotees, sadhus, bhaktas, right? Do suitable work, dedicate all to Vasudeva and the saints and the devotees. Whenever it's time, listen to the scriptures with faith in the company of devotees. So this is what we're doing, right? This is what think about it. St. Patrick's Day today. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Most people are not. They're drinking a different type of nectar tonight. Right? We're all drinking this nectar, right? That nectar will only give hangover. This nectar hopefully will give eternal, will allow us to bit by bit unleash our... Right? Uncover our eternal nature, right? Right, the company of devotees. Satsange, by this satsang. So we call this a satsang. What is satsang? Satsang means fellowship with truth. Sat, this truth is not just sat means devotee. Sat means saint, right? Sat means truth. That sat means eternal, has many meanings, right? So satsang, when you associate by this company, by this association with the truth, with that which is eternal, this katamrita, right, and the saints, by this satsang, says one slowly becomes detached, right? And he says, and so if you're a householder, he's talking about householders, right? People who are married and with children, and what is it? What might one eventually, slowly have to become detached from? It's a painful thing to think, but maybe wife or husband, children, right? Because this is not an anti-marriage. This is not an anti-family statement, right? Because eventually you're going to become separated from such people, guaranteed, right? Through time, through distance, through the grave, right? Our family and our dearmost family, they'll not be with us forever. We will not be with them forever, right? It's not amrita. It's not eternal, right? It's mitta. It's temporary, right? So we should. He's telling how to prepare, right? It's because while we're in the midst of our family and responsibilities, we cannot not take it very seriously. We should take it very seriously, but we shouldn't become bewildered, knowing that we should always remember that it's still a temporary situation, right? I remember one saint, one sadhu, told me. He says, I was talking about my family. He says, that's very, very wonderful, right? He says, but they weren't always your family, right? You know, it's like you've had thousands of mothers and fathers, right? And you'll have maybe thousands of more, hopefully not too many more. At least a few good ones are worth a thousand average mothers. There's no such thing as a bad mother and father. But you've had so many, right? So which one, and so where are they? What's your attachment to them? What's your relationship to them? Right, some scara, some tendencies in this birth, right? So it's hard to imagine that something that we hold so dear will not be even be remembered in the future, right? You know, it's like they say, you know, have you ever seen those shows with the After Humans or something, where they show like what will happen to LA in 10 years after humans are gone, in 50 years, like, but it's likely that in 1,000 years, Los Angeles will be, in 10,000 years, Los Angeles will be a level of colored sand, right? Well, all, you know, that could be it, right? This glorious city, so much energy and life and accomplishment and passion and crime and everything mixed up will only be that, right? So it's good to remember. It's good to take it seriously, but it's also good to remember that it won't always be so, right? So this is he's repairing. So by how do we do so? By meditating on that which is eternal. Then we see we're not bewildered by that which is temporary. If you don't have any reference to the eternal, you'll definitely be bewildered by the temporary, right? By the temporariness of the temporary. There's a verse in the Gita. He says, yes, in this body, this body is constantly changing. We go from childhood to youth to old age, right? And so similarly, at the time of death, this body ceases to be taken another body. It's a simple fact, right? Then it says, dhiras tatanamuyati. A sober person, dhiras, is not bewildered by this. And people are incredibly bewildered by this. You go to a funeral. It's like, how could this have happened? It's amazing. I've heard this at every funeral I've ever been to. How could this have happened? It's like, the one thing guaranteed to happen. You know, the only thing, actually the only thing besides say, taxes, and the only thing besides taxes guaranteed to happen, is but we're bewildered by it. We don't see, because we don't realize that which is eternal, the soul is eternal, and the body's changing. And we're bewildered by the body. We expect the bodies. We're bewildered when the body changes. It's the nature of the body to change. But unless you won't see that unless you see you have a reference point where that is eternal. So by this Katamrita, by listening to the stories of the saints, stories of God and His avatars and the company of devotees and saints, then by this satsang, slowly one becomes detached from spouse and family. And then it gives a beautiful definition. He says, like. Swapna vat utita. Swapna means, maybe you know, dream. Like waking from a dream. Right? When you're in the middle of a dream, all the characters are very real, especially the good dream. All the characters are really bad, really good dreams and really bad dreams. Everything's very, very real. Right? But then when you wake up, slowly you wake up, and you're like, and still that those characters are kind of there. Right, but then slowly, and pretty soon you may not even remember the characters. It's like, oh man, it was a good dream. I forgot it. Right, and you have the journal. You remember, write it down like this. You know, they have all these techniques to remember their dreams. Right, but then you realize, oh, it was just a dream. Right, you know, it's like it seemed so real. And in the dream, for the dreamer, it's real. If you get stabbed in a dream, it feels like you've been stabbed. The pain is real. Right, but how real? Right, so he's giving very. It's a little fierce. He's doing it gently, but it's actually pretty harsh instructions, right? By meditating upon God and listening to the scriptures, we have to be careful. What will happen? Like we may actually begin to wake up and see what we think is so important. Maybe isn't as important as it is important, but it may not be as permanent and all important as we previously thought. So. That's one thing. Then how are we supposed to earn our money? Part of a grahastha life, you have to. It's your responsibility when you have children and a wife and children and husband. You have to raise them. You have to earn money. You have to have a job, right? That's a given, right? So how much? What do we do? He says, earn enough wealth to keep one's life going, right? We have to. You have to earn enough to live. In every situation, for every person, that may be different. Right, in India you may not need so much, right? And if you want to live in Laguna, you may need a little bit more. The problem, right? But how much do you need to live, right? Right. So earning enough wealth to keep one's life going, right? Learned and unattached, one should behave as if one is attached to the world. Right. That's interesting. Behave as if the world's very real, but know that it's not real. This is a very difficult thing. So, Sri Ramakrishna gives a perfect story to this. He says that if you have a, trying to remember, a nanny, right? And so the nanny treats the children, her children, as if they're her children. Says, oh, my Hari, my Krishna, right? My son, you do just like, as if they're your own son, right? But she knows they're not her actual children. And she treats the house where she's working as if it's her house. But she knows her house is in the village, Sri Ramakrishna. It's not her actual home, right? But she has to, to be a good nanny, she has to behave as if she was a parent, as if that's her house, right? And take care of the children properly and train them properly. But she knows in her heart of hearts that they're not actually her children, right? You know, it's like it's a heart. So Sri Ramakrishna said, he told this to M, I think, right? On the first, one of the first meetings with M, the recorder of the gospel. He says, how are we to live? He asked the same question. What about, all you're saying all nice things, but how are we supposed to live? He says, live like that nanny, right? Do all your duties. He says, do all your duties in relationship with wife, with children, with workers, with employees, with friends, with co-workers, with all those things. But know that that's not your real relations, right? Behave as if they were, as if, my tongue is off today, as if they were yours, right? With full passion, with full attention, but secretly you know, right? You have some knowledge, some place, a perspective that you're not. He said another thing is like a tortoise who lays, tortoise lays its eggs on the sand, I mean like this, and then swims the seven seas. Does everything a tortoise does. But where is her mind? Her mind's on the beach with her eggs. Right? He says, like that, do everything, do all your duties. But you know where your mind, your real source is, where the eggs are. Right? Where on the beach there, you know, in your eternal home like this. So he says, earning enough wealth to keep one's life going, learned and unattached. He says, at least uses the word Pandita, one should be with good knowledge and virakto and be knowledgeable, have pandita, be wisdom and virakto, be renounced, but act as if you don't have knowledge and you're very attached. Right, this is a very tricky thing, right? Very difficult thing to do. That's why it's to be the ideal householder, according to this, is not an easy thing. To be an ideal anything is not an easy thing. Right? That's why they call it an ideal. Something to work towards, right? This is what we're struggling for. We should agree with relatives, parents, children, siblings, friends, and others. We should agree with all of them. I mean, and so this could mean two. It says, but not take them seriously. It has two different meanings. It means, one thing is like, oh, say yes to everybody, but don't do anything. That could be something. But that's probably not the original meaning. It probably is, and the Sanskrit can be taken a few different ways. That's why I had in parentheses the two ways of doing it. It says, do everything for your, right? I mean, do everything for your relatives, your parents, your children, siblings, friends, and others, but do it without attachment. That's very difficult. It's easy to be detached when you live, like it's not that easy to be detached if you live in a cave, in an ashram, in a temple, without anything, like it's difficult. How much, Jaima, how much more difficult it will be to be detached while living in the world of friends, family, children, relatives, parents, spouse, like this. Much more difficult. But this is, he dared to ask the question to Narada. It's very dangerous to ask a serious question to a sadhu. A good sadhu like Narada Muni, he's not going to, you know, very dangerous. He says, and it has this interesting, he says, from sky, from earth, or from chance, right? How are we to earn our living? How are we to get our food? How do we get our money? This is a very poetic way of saying. He says, divyam bhauma, but from the sky, from the divya, means from, what does that mean? From rain, right? Rain comes and gives us crops, right? So either through farming, getting your food this way, by from earth. Earth means by means earth. The term here, bhauma, means earth and oceans. Means by mining. Means from the ground, from, you know, metals and you know, like that, or by chance, whatever other type of things it means. By any, this is a way of saying by any way, honest way, you gather your food and your money, right? No, all property comes from Achyuta. Everything is coming from Bhagavan, from the Lord, from the infinite, inconceivable Achyuta, Lord. Everything that comes to you, whether you grow it, because if you grow it, oh, I did this, right? But no, where is it coming from? You did not. You can without rain, nothing will grow, right? And so minimally, so God is sending rain, and we're getting food. So know that even if you work, if you're a farmer, and you're getting that's coming from God for your benefit. If you're tilling, if you're mining, if you're collecting, if you're working, everything's coming. Remember, everything's coming from God, from sky, from earth, or from chance. Knowing that all property came from Achyuta for use in maintaining life. No, everything comes from God. Why has He arranged everything so that we could live? He's arranged. Sri Ramakrishna said, "A child is born with a need for milk, and before that happens, milk comes in the breast of a mother." Right, so everything needed for the child is automatically provided. Right, so everything needed for human existence, for your existence, has been provided. Right, it's being provided. So you remember where it comes from. Everything's coming from the Lord for our use, to keep our life going. Therefore, it says, an intelligent person, Buddha, an intelligent a person, does not over-endeavor. Over-endeavor, it's not that we shouldn't work, but we have, actually, one term is not used here, I don't think. Maybe. No, but in other words used, but the term used in other places called ugra karma, means horrible work. How much people have to, I mean, horrible work is like, people have to do the most horrible things to make money. Horrible things in order to get what they don't need. Right? You know, some horrible work could just mean like, oh, I mean, people have to work the whole day and they neglect their families. Like, in order to have enough, in order to provide more than your family needs for the benefit of your family, you have to work so hard you neglect your family. Right, you know, something like that. That's ugra karma, right? Or so desperate to have more than you actually need, you start selling drugs and getting. And if you start selling drugs, you have to have people to buy drugs. I mean, you have to get children addicted. You know, if you think like this, or you have to, or you start. You know, you have factory farms and slaughterhouses and like the most horrible things, in order to give people and to get what you don't actually really need. Right, what you really need has already been provided. It's provided, right? If you live a simple, honest life, you'll get what you need. Use that, worship God, worship in the company of devotees, hear the scriptures, and slowly wake up from the dream. That's the message, right? But if you take this, but if you don't forget this, if you forget this, you end up doing the most abominable things, right? Or you know, people drive 10 hours. You know, people who have to drive to San Francisco every week to work, right? You know, that it seems like how much work you have to do for what benefit, right? Your cost-benefit analysis, you have to think, you know. So from sky, from earth, for chance, or from chance, know that all property came from Achyuta for the use of maintaining life, an intelligent person does not over-endeavor. One is entitled to what can fill the stomach. Right, so this is also something. One of our friends was just telling me. He was showing me his work office, and very successful business he has. Devotee who comes here, and he was showing me one room where they do marketing. Right, and he says, "Beckley, we haven't used it in years." And he says, "All my employees are saying we should do marketing. We should do mailings and get more business." He says, "We have enough business." Right, he's successful. He has a successful business. He says, "In the night, I can only put 2 rotis in my stomach. A third roti gives me indigestion, right? You know, so how much, a poor person or the richest person can only put a couple pieces of bread in his stomach. Other than that, it ruins health, right? So how much is, you have, and you have the right to that, right? It's different, you know, somebody working in a store will have maybe a different expense for their roti than somebody who makes a lot of money like that, but still, only a few pieces of bread fit in the stomach. You can only sleep in one bed at a time. Only drive one car at a time. Right? So you can have more than one car, but to get a second car, what you don't actually need, how much ugra karma, how much you have to work for that? Right? If you put, actually, I haven't done this in a while because it depresses me, but I used to do this. You might remember, it's like here's this, like, oh, this is, like, I don't know how much this lamp costs. Not very expensive. I think you gave it to us, right? So, this lamp. Not very expensive, but you know, you get a nice lamp, like a Tiffany lamp or like this, right? Like, you know, it's like that may cost, I don't know, we got it on sale. It's a religious nonprofit, right? But we want something beautiful. But like, you see that and you think, let's say it costs $500. I don't remember what it costs. Let's say it costs $500. right? And if you're a worker, how many hours of work is $500? Right? So many hours of work in order to have something you don't actually need. Right? You know, so that's the thing, is how much what else could you be doing with that? Right? Or with that money or with that time? If you earn that money, what else could you do with that money? Or if you didn't have to earn that money, what you could do with that time, right? So this is the thing, one is entitled to what can fill the stomach means what you need to live comfortably. Not these aren't sannyasis that have to live in a different way. This is not ascetic. This is householders. I mean, your stomach, your family's stomach, and all those who are dependent upon you. I mean, your parents, your cousins, your dogs, everybody. You know, everybody goes into that. Everybody has a dependent. Householders in the tradition of Vedic system, they're the only ones earning money. Brahmacharis can't earn money, vanaprasas can't earn money, and sannyasis can't earn money. So you can't tell a householder they shouldn't earn money. Because who's going to figure those brahmacharis, vanaprasas, and sannyasis? Right? They're the only ones, they're the economic engine behind everything. Right? So, but their duty is to fill their stomach and fill the stomach of those who are dependent upon them. Right? You know, it's like more than that, it says, he uses a very sharp term. It says, taking more than this, sa stenaha. That person is a thief. More than that, you're stealing what somebody else needs. If you take more than you need, you're taking it from somebody else who needs it, right? And he says, danda arhati. He deserves beating, punishment, danda. Right? A thief requires to be punished, right? It's not that we should say, oh, people, we should overthrow the upper class and take away, you know, punish them. There's a movement for that right now. We'll see how far it goes, right? But it actually means, what is this punishment by nature? Because these are Lord Achyuta has given everything, right, for our benefit, for our maintenance, sufficient, right? We live honest, pure lives. We'll have more than enough, right? If we take more than that, then who are we stealing from? Nature itself, from God, right? And therefore, what happens? If you eat more than two rotis, you get, nature punishes you, indigestion. Right, or if you eat the wrong, you can see, it's like if you spend all your time working and not so much more than you need, then you lose your family, or you lose connection with your family. You can whip like this. Nature itself punishes you. If you take more than you need, you get punished by nature, because in the Gita there's a beautiful, I can't say beautiful, my favorite verses, but these are beautiful verses spoken by Bhagavan, so they're beautiful. But he says, if one eats food not being offered to others, right? Not as, like, one eats sin. It's the same principle is based upon this. One is not taking. Jaima, jaima. So one is a thief and deserves the punishment. So whose stomach are we supposed to fill? This is interesting. Deer, camels, asses, monkeys, mice, snakes, birds, and flies. this is the categories of animals, right? He says, all these are like one's own children. So we have to feed our children. We have to feed not just our children, right? Everybody is dependent upon us. So this is a hint at what's called Panchyagya, which the verse will describe that shortly. Daima. So when you do, the next section we probably skip because it's a little technical on Shraddh, which is when you do rites for your ancestors, to feed your ancestors. You also have to list any animals that were dependent on you. Like maybe your pets from earlier growing up, your pets you have to list. Right? Because you have to feed them, well, they're dependent on you, and they're in your family. Right? Maybe not by birth, but by dependence. If you're feeding them, right? Therefore it's your duty. So even, you know, if a priest will ask you, list your animal's name that were dependent upon you. And you do offer offerings for them also, not just for your grandmother and grandfather like this, also to your pets, right? Because these are also just like children, right? Without because actually an animal in nature is a perfect animal in nature. But as soon as it becomes domesticated, it becomes a child, right? A cat, if you leave it out, you know, or a dog, it wouldn't know what to do. Luckily, sometimes their instinct is strong enough that their dogness or catness comes out. But you see, like, they become like dependent children, right? And so if they're dependent children, we have to feed. It's our duty also. It says, all these are like one's children. How little difference there is between them and one's children. So he's asking, what is the difference? right? You know, so we have to feed everybody. Trivargam, what's the verse? Trivargam, one should, a householder should not over endeavor for Trivargam. Trivargam means the three goals of life. And this is Dharma. There's four goals, traditional goals of life given the Vedas. Dharma, which we're talking about, right? Duti. Artha means wealth, right? I mean, we need to work for wealth, a legitimate objective of life. And kama, enjoyment. Right? These are natural. And then final is moksha, liberation. He says, these three, dharma, kama, and artha, means duti, wealth, and enjoyment, especially wealth and enjoyment, is only really allowed for the grahasthas, right? To make money and enjoy and get pleasure, that's legitimate in married life. That's the only time it's allowed or natural. Because even that be the case, don't make that the goal of life. Don't only focus on that, right? Don't overemphasize. At the expense of, what is Jesus says, what profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul, right? And only grahasthas can gain the whole world, but don't lose your soul in the process, right? Don't over-endeavor. Instead, he says, considering time and place, according to situation, accept what comes easily. It means easily here, it means daivya. Daivya means destiny, means from God, or it means karma. Right, our own karmas have set up where we are now. We're all in this room because of our past. You're in these bodies because of your past. You're in your jobs and the amount of food you're eating and your paycheck because also your past. Earlier in this life or previous lives also. Right, so we have to behave intelligently and responsibly, but our enjoyments and suffering are coming from our past. So be satisfied and considerate of time and place. Live simple life. Don't overly focus on material acquisitions, right? Be satisfied with what's coming from your own destiny. He says, the necessities of life, this is interesting rules here, or advice, the necessities of life should be given. Now, here's an interesting three. We talked about pets and stuff like that. In India, dogs aren't pets, right? They're not considered clean. And now they are, but in ancient times, they wouldn't be common pets. And they're considered not a clean animal, right? Ritually clean. They can be materially clean, but not ritually clean. He says, but even these unclean animals, they also, they have their needs. That we have to use your money that you get honestly, without too much endeavor, also satisfy dogs. He says, aggaha. Swa means dog, aggaha. Aggaha means without home. Means homeless. The homeless should also be fed, right? And anta, Ava sadhu and means, and this is like very low people, right? In socially low people, that they're called chandalas. These are like dog. In scriptures use a term called dog eater, right? And there are, this is we in Vedic understanding, you can tell somebody's station by the food they eat. Actually, you can tell one person told me, one sadhu told me, you can tell somebody's nature by the words they use and the food they eat. These are the two indicators, right? The food that they're attracted to, right? So you can imagine people who are eating dogs are not the highest, most refined people, right? I remember walking with one of my friends in Rishikesh, and you may have been with us, I forget. We're walking, we're buying some villagers. And Rishikesh is interesting, it's a vegetarian town. It's illegal to sell meat or alcohol in Rishikesh, right? But the tribals, the villagers, or the villagers in that area, they're exempt from this rule because they don't have to follow this, you know, culturally section, you know, on this. Due to religious sentiments, the Hindus don't want at least this holy ground to be desecrated by alcohol or by meat, right? But people who lived there before, people came there and made these rules, are exempt from these rules, right? As we're walking by, and we saw this one family, and they seemed nice enough, right? And my friend, he almost aghast at them, and he said, they eat pig. It was like the most horrible. I mean, it's like us here, everybody, we look around, eats pig, right? Most people in this country eat pig, right? But pig is, I hate to tell the truth, but in India, pigs actually eat stool, right? That's almost a preferred food. So they're not considered the cleanest animals. So eating them is not considered a very high class thing. But even these people, pig eaters, right, in this way of understanding, means the most abominable behavior that we'd normally think, most unrefined people, you would say, dogs, homeless people, the most unrefined, they also need to be taken care of. So our money has to be used in this to serve them also, according to their need. Right. One should not. And then it says, and here it's like, and one should not. So one shouldn't be so. And it says one should not be too attached, so attached to one's spouse that that spouse can't go and serve. This is an interesting thing. You know, exactly. People use the word wife. I've translated spouse, right? And what this means is like that it's a tendency in Indian culture, perhaps, have the wife always be at home and never do it, and never, you know, like what if, but if the man's working in that old culture, right, who's going to serve? Who's going to do charity? Who's going to be feeding the homeless? Who's going to be feeding animals? If the husband's earning wage, right, the wife would naturally do that in that situation. Or the other spouse, you could translate it that way, right? So he says one shouldn't be so controlling, attached, and possessive one spouse that you stop them from doing their duty to feed and to serve, right? He says the wife or the spouse who is usually so guarded by most people, out of attachment for one spouse, some even kill oneself. Some people commit suicide, and they'll even kill their parents and their guru. This is how attached we are to our. We can be attached to our spouse. He says, if you can give up this attachment, he says, you conquer even God. You conquer God himself. Right? One, that's a big statement. So this is telling, Yudhisthira is asking, what about us who are attached to our family? If you can be, you can do all this, behave like a perfect householder, but not be attached to your family. Be attached to your family, but not be attached to your family, you conquer even God. Because actually it's a statement, not even God can do that. Right, God's attached to his family. Where it means we have more renunciation. So it's a rhetorical device to say something like, you conquer even God himself. Right? But it's showing the dignity of such a goal. And then he says, so what good is attachment to this body? Right? Right? This body mean this body or the body of one's spouse? To the body, which becomes krimi, vit bashma. This is what becomes of all, you know, these three words. This is what this beautiful body, not this beautiful, this is not a beautiful body, but these beautiful bodies, I can, with great appreciation, say. Eventually, this is, I hate to be the bringer, I think to be the bringer of bad news today, sorry about all these negative things. Will, yeah, on St. Patrick's Day, just see where we should be. Face down somewhere, you know, being good Americans, pretending to be good Irish, pretending to be, you know. But instead, I come with this good news or bad news, is that this body will become either krimi, means worms, right? Because eventually it will die and be buried. Right? Actually, there are three ways of being traditionally disposed of. The physical body is disposed of three ways, right? One, it's buried, in which case it decomposes and becomes worms. It becomes insects, right? Vit means stool, means, or it's like in sky burials like this in Tibet, like that you feed it to the cut it up, feed it to the birds, and you get pooped right out, right? It becomes stool, right? Or bashma, ash, or it's burned and becomes ash. So this beautiful body, which we work so hard and we're so attached to, we're willing to do anything for, we swoon after all the different things, you know, we write poetry about everything like this, right? But it's great. But remember, don't forget, the end result of it. You think you should never, a householder should never ask a sadhu what's about householder life. This is what they're always going to get. Your body is going to become stool, worms, or ash, right? He says, what good is such attachment to such a body that becomes worm, stool, or ash? And then he said, but this is the point of it. What is this body, right? This body or my spouse's body, the term is used both ways. In comparison, it says Atma Nibasha Chaddihi to the self. Right? We're trying to catch the eternal within the changing. This changing body, it could be wonderful, but we think about it, what it's ultimately going to become, and compare that to the Atman. And he says, Atman, which would be resplendent like the sky, infinite, dazzling with glory, like in other places, like 10 million suns, right? Compared to this little body, which is wonderful, which we're even to kill our, to commit suicide for, kill somebody for, in the previous verse, right? What can that be in comparison to the self, the infinite self, all-pervading like the sky? It says, one should, since that said, what should one, how should one actually, that's all fine and dandy, Swamiji, how are we actually supposed to do this? How are we supposed to accomplish this? This is all scary, idealistic talk, right? For St. Patrick's Day. How are we supposed to actually do it? He says, one should subsist on what remains after performing the fivefold sacrifices. Means what after sacrifice, what remains we call prasad. Here it's called siddha. Siddha means siddha means perfect. It also means cooked, right? Accomplished. So once like we do like a yajna, whatever is left, we eat, we can take that. Once you subsist after doing yajna, right? Without the sense of ownership. So this is interesting. What is this fivefold yajna? It will be defined in a second, in the next verse. Such a wise person is considered a mahatma. So if you live your life, Gita also, third chapter of the Gita goes great in, second or third chapter of the Gita, third chapter goes into this a lot. He says, you do your duty, you worship God by doing, and the way we worship God is through this fivefold sacrifice. And we'll talk about that. What's left after that? Utilize your money, utilize it from your work, and do your duties in these five categories: worship of God, worship of self, like this. What's left of that, you enjoy fully. Right? It will be roughly what fills the stomach nicely, guaranteed. It's the way it's set up. Krishna says in the Gita, if you do this, you'll satisfy all your desires. Right? You can actually enjoy everything. There's nothing. We're not trying to tell people not to enjoy. You'll enjoy everything. But in a clean way, a healthy way, right? So one should subsist on what remains after performing the fivefold sacrifice and give up the sense of ownership. Such a wise person is called Mahatma. Mahatma is like a rishi, a saint, a great soul. And you see, and there's many so-called Mahatmas, Swamis and Gurus and Yogis like this, who are not real Mahatmas. And there's many householders who are real Mahatmas. A householder who can live an honest life without attachment and doing his duty perfectly and taking, being satisfied with what's left after serving everybody. That person, Narada Muni, the greatest of saints, who is a Mahatma, is saying that person is a Mahatma. That person is a saint. Right? Better than a saint. Most saints don't do this. Saint means sadhus like this, right? What are those fivefold sacrifices? Devam, Rishim, Nri, Bhutani, Pitri. Deva means the gods, serve the gods. And that's what we do by puja and yajna, fire sacrifice. That's serving the gods. Right? Why do we have to serve the gods? Because somebody is providing all the ingredients for our life. Right? Somebody is providing rain, wind, air. Right, so we call the personification, if you get into anthropology of religion like this, we'd say the personification of natural forces. This is the source of religion, right? There's some truth to that, because there is personification of natural forces, right? There is somebody regulating. The devas are regulating all aspects of life. Without them, we could not live. And so we get air, we get rain. Right, like today we got very nice rain, tomorrow a little bit more rain, right? Because of that, we're very looking forward. Our gardens hopefully will bloom for the spring, right? This new rain will come and everything will be very healthy. We'll get some good flowers and food, right? So we're getting it from them, but without giving anything back, right? That's also considered, if you get something and not pay for it, in popular culture we call that stealing. Right, so that's, and actually Krishna uses that term in the Gita. He says that person is the same thing, he's a thief, deserving of punishment. Right, if you get milk, you go to the store and get some milk, right, and don't pay. So many things have to happen to get that milk to you, right? So if you're dude, so it would be, you know, you have to, at least some money has to be given to compensate for the people who are doing that job. And it says in the Gita, the scriptures, that devas are unique. They can only provide the resources for subsistence, but they themselves cannot eat their own results. Right? They can provide the things to create food, but they can't feed themselves. Right? So the arrangement is that we take their grace in the form of everything, this bountiful thing nature has given us, and with that we feed them. And he says, mutually satisfying each other, enjoy your life, that Krishna says. Right? This is a divine economic system. Right? We pay the powerhouse sends electricity. Right? If we don't get electricity, we can't cook our food, and we can't make money, and without money we can't pay them. It works this way, right? So yajna is like this. You'll see very often, mysteriously so, when you do a good yajna, it will usually rain. It's one of the benefits of yajna, right? The immediate result is that it rains because the devas begin to be pleased, right? And sometimes if there's too much rain, you can do a yajna and stop it from raining. It really is mysterious, but actually, I mean, especially there's some pundits that their only job is to go where there's droughts in India and do big, expensive yajna, but it usually brings rain. They know how to. He says, we've broken that system. So the relationship between the devas, we're so disconnected from nature and natural forces and the powers behind our natural forces. So the first yajna is puja, worshipping the devas, right? It means through temple worship and yajna, we feed the subtle astral beings that feed us. One thing. Then rishi, the sages. Sages give us this knowledge. How we're supposed to live, this transcendental knowledge. How do we feed the rishis? How do we serve them with our yajna for them? By study, right? And by speaking and listening. This is the way you feed. You're dedicating so much of your time, an hour here. Think about it. The St. Patrick's Day, you're listening to this. This is your feeding of the rishis. You honor the rishis, what they're giving us. And so you dedicate your time. People also publish books. They distribute knowledge. They open schools. And different things according to their ability. Minimally, you can listen. And maybe you can start a Vedic school to train another generation of children. You know, this is a way of serving the rishis, right? And on following their instructions is also how you serve the rishis. They give us a spiritual knowledge. So deva, rishi, nri means man, humans, right? So we have to serve humans, right? And that means, and the same thing, I talk about this a lot, that if all human beings in Orange County were to disappear, only we'd left, you know, we'd probably die in about a month. Right, because nobody to purify, nobody to put chemicals in the water to kill the germs. Even that, right? The tap on our sink would become poison. Somebody's doing that, right? We don't live isolated. We live in a society where we're all serving each other, and we don't honor that. We need each other, right? So we have to pay. We have to pay into that system, right? And so this is social work and like that, making sure that our responsibilities to those who serve us. And we're taking service from is done by paying properly, as well as serving those who are less fortunate. The man, we need human beings. Bhuta means beings, other beings like animals and plants, right? All the bees were to die, civilization would crumble. We couldn't generate enough food to feed ourselves. If it wasn't for bees, right? So bees are very important, right? So there could be a service of developing beehives, making sure there's enough bees, right? Or feeding birds, feeding animals, feeding cows, right? This is developing parks, planting trees. This is Bhuta Seva, type of yajna. So a householder who generates money does puja for the gods and temples, arranges for the distribution of spiritual knowledge, follows such knowledge, feeds other living human beings and pays for the economy to keep going, feeds nature, right, takes care of nature, animals, and plants like this. And if you see, still you see little old ladies feeding sugar to ants. Right, that's bhut puja. There's a tradition where many people do, a lot of Brahmins do. At the beginning of their meal, they take a little bit of all their food and make it into a ball. Put it aside. Later, they'll go and put it and let some birds eat it. A little bit of their food has to be given, minimally. Right, a little before they take. Right. And last one, bhutam and Pitri means ancestors, your family, right? Ancestors means your immediate ancestors, means your mother and father. If they're still living, they have to be honored and taken care of. Because without them, we wouldn't know how to go to the bathroom properly. We wouldn't know how to hold a fork, have to think about this, you know, like now they may bother us a little bit, right? But if you think about it, without them, we wouldn't know anything. We wouldn't do anything. We would have died one day, right? How much effort that our family did, our parents did. But then like that, we come in a biological lineage, right? That gave us this body, didn't just come from our parents. The DNA for this body came from generation after generations, right? So we have a duty to all of our ancestors, our family and our parents, parents' parents, all the way up our ancestors, right? So serving the devas, the rishis, humans, living beings, and the forefathers with what is earned, with the money you earned, in the same way, is the same as worshiping the Supreme Person. Worshiping these five is the same as worshiping, he says, this Purusha. Worshiping that Supreme Self, the Supreme Godhead. The way we worship Godhead is by doing puja, by reading the scriptures, by serving each other, taking care of nature, and taking care of our ancestors. That is, use your money in this way, that is worship of God. That Yudhisthira's Narada is saying to householders. If one has the knowledge, skill, and ingredients, then one can also worship with Agnihotra, in accordance with the scripture. If you know and you have that, you can also do fire, so you can do like formalized puja, right? But it doesn't mean that you have to only do worship in the fire is worship. Right, feeding people is worship. Taking care of your parents is worship. Right, not just doing puja. Right, it says Bhagavan. This is the final verses here. Bhagavan is never satisfied by the offering of ghee into the mouth of a fire. Is never as satisfied by the offering of ghee into the mouth of the fire as he is pouring ghee into the mouth of a holy person. Mean feeding a holy person, feeding a Brahmin, feeding a Sadhu, feeding a devotee, inviting people to your house, good people, sattvic people, feeding them. That is more pleasing. He says it is pleasing to Bhagavan to pour ghee into the fire. We do it every month, right? We'll be doing it on Wednesday. You can see the effect, how powerful it is. But also, the puja, if we could do all this puja, and we can do pour gallons of ghee into the fire, but the puja is not complete until all the devotees have been fed. Right, that's tradition. If you know, because it says if you have the knowledge, skill, and ingredients, we have some knowledge, some ability, and we have the ingredients to do homa, so we're doing it. It's part of the puja. But that's not as pleasing as pouring food into the mouth of good people, right, into the devotees and saints. Therefore, this is the final verse, therefore, God, the inner witness, this is Chetra Gnyam, the inner, the self of all, the witness of everything, should be worshipped by serving holy men, right? By serving holy men, devas, the gods, and all beings, and everybody else, all society, right? According to their needs and according to your abilities. This is his final. He's going to talk a few more general things about Shraddha and things like pilgrimage and like that. But this is the main point. Therefore, a big therefore is like, after all this, this is the point. Therefore, householders, how do you worship God? Right? How do we attain that supreme goal? He says, earn your living naturally, honestly. Don't take too much. Right? Don't over-endeavor doing horrible things to get something you don't really want or need. And use your money and your ability to do your duty to your parents, society, to nature, to the rishis, to your religion, to the gods, to God, right? By doing this, this is the worship of God, right? By serving, and especially by serving the devotees, the holy men, right? The gods and all beings, right? So you have, that puts in perspective, using people, like simple teachings of Ninkurli Baba. Serve people, feed people, remember God. Right, it seems very simple. Oh, it's almost like simplistic. That's no real scripture knowledge. That's the whole thing is in that one verse. Right, the whole three chapters of the Gita are in that verse. Right, I've shown actually, I've actually written on this point, showing how this simple statement is not just the whimsical nature of one sadhu. Right, he's summarizing the whole dharma. Actually, when one of the last things he said when living, right, he says, "I've lived my life spreading dharma." That was his final statement. This life I've spent spreading dharma. What's that dharma? This is a dharma. Feed people, love people, serve people, feed people. This is how you serve God. But do so remembering God. Don't get caught. Right? Do your duty, but don't get caught and serve. Right? And such a person, he says, is a mahatma, right? You know, so you're asking to do the householder. This is the householder is not a householder. Householder is a saint. A real householder is a saint, right? Most saints are not saints. Most saints are householders. You know, we have big ashrams, big institutions, and publicity machines to keep themselves going and get more disciples, to get more money, to get, you know, this is, they're businessmen. Most sadhus are businessmen and workers, right? But he's saying, but a householder, if in this way, that person's actually a sadhu, mahatma. He's better than mahatma. He conquers God himself. That's a very big statement, right? So up to this point tonight, thank you for your kind attention. Next week, I think, we have 1 week, and then we have, I think we have Ram Navami is coming. I think it's also on Saturday or Sunday?
Saturday.
It's on Saturday, no? 31st. So that then, rather than the talk, we'll do special puja for Lord Ram, Divine Appearance Day. It's also the day that Ninkurli Baba's Murti came. Interesting that his arrangement, because we ordered him from the person who made him for us. And he was supposed to come considerably earlier, but somehow or another, I made the mistake and wrote the wrong address. So it took a long time to come. So finally, the address was correct, and he came on. We never knew when he was coming. He actually came on Ram Navami morning, which is perfect. On Ram's birthday, he came, and very, very nice. So that's auspicious day. So next week, I think there's one section. I'll skip the section on Shraddh because it gets too technical. Those who want to do ceremonies for their ancestors, you can read that section. But it's maybe not necessary to... These sections, I think, are so dense and complicated. You can spend 3 weeks on, you know, like literally you can spend weeks on how to brush your teeth. It can be like that, you know. And it may not be the best use of our the best use of your Saturday night. I'm also conscious of that, so we're trying to keep it a little bit focused. Anyway, thank you for your kind attention. We'll take the leftovers from our sacrifice and see how it goes. Jai Guru Maharaj ki Jai.